Our scripture reading today is from Luke 10, verses 25 to 37. A legal expert stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to gain eternal life?" Jesus replied, "What is written in the law? How do you interpret it?" He responded, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But the legal expert wanted to prove that he was right. So he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. He encountered thieves who stripped him naked, beat him up, and left him near death. Now it just so happened that a priest was also going down the same road. When he saw the injured man, he crossed over to the other side of the road and went on his way. Likewise, a Levite came by that spot, saw the injured man, and crossed over to the other side of the road and went on his way. A Samaritan, who was on a journey, came to where the man was. But when he saw him, he was moved with compassion. The Samaritan went to him and bandaged his wounds, tending them with oil and wine. Then he placed the wounded man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took two full days' worth of wages and gave them to the innkeeper. He said, 'Take care of him, and when I return, I will pay you back for any additional costs.' What do you think? Which one of these three was a neighbor to the man who encountered thieves?" Then the legal expert said, "The one who demonstrated mercy toward him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise."
If you're visiting us this morning, we're preaching through the book of Luke, and this is the Sunday where we fall upon this passage, a Sunday when we commission ministers to help care for people in need in our community. It's a Sunday where Paul Bach asked us to sing a song of prayer towards our community, that we would be servants to our community, and that that community may in fact allow us to be that. And those things weren't planned. They all just sort of come together in a way that feel really important to me this morning as we look at this text. Of all the stories that we find in the book of Luke, I think the one that Justin read is one of the most familiar to us. Even if a person's never cracked open a Bible or shown up at a gathering of worship, they're likely to connect the story of being a good Samaritan with this parable that Jesus told. A scholar of the law shows up to try to test Jesus, this time on what does it mean for a person to be able to inherit eternal life. Rather than answering him, Jesus turns it back on the fellow and says, "Well, how do you see it? How do you read the law?" And his answer is flawless. Combining both the heart of the Old Testament, or combining the heart of the Old Testament by coupling the command to love God with all one's energy, with every ounce, every bit of devotion, which comes from Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, and then also loving your neighbor practically, not just in your mind, not just in your heart, but practically loving your neighbor, which comes from Leviticus 19, 18. This is not some new teaching. This is from old. People understood this. So Jesus and the scholar are in agreement, which should have been a cause for celebration. They're on the same side, and everybody should be happy. But this scholar is not particularly a curious seeker, truly interested in learning more, in growing deeper, in aligning his own heart with the heart of God. He's trying to sniff out whether or how much Jesus is a heretic. And what his ulterior motives might be from this would-be Messiah. So he presses a little bit further and says, indeed, but who is my neighbor? And that's when we get to the familiar parable. Man's going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is this long, windy stretch of road where there's rocks and it's a desert place. It's the perfect hideout for robbers to wait in hiding and then attack a person, which is in fact what happens in the story. He's beaten and stripped and left for dead and probably looked dead to the two religious leaders who come along. We don't know for sure in the story, but he's probably a member of that person who's beaten is probably a family member of his Jewish family. But rather than coming close to see how or if they might be helpful, those two religious folks steer clear. They distance themselves from the person lying there in pain. Later, a Samaritan comes along who sees him, has pity on him, bandages him up, pours oil and wine on his wounds, loads him onto his burrow, takes him to the inn, and then gives money for the person's care and maintenance. Of the three, which one was the true neighbor to the man who was beaten, Jesus asks. We all know the answer. The one who showed mercy, which I would define as compassion in action. But Jesus drives the point home a little bit further in the parable by saying to the man, more than getting the right answer, he says, I want you now to go home and do likewise. As we said several times along the way in our study of the book of Luke, to know the truth is to live the truth. To truly know the truth is to live it out. Since the story is so familiar, it's actually changed the meaning of the word Samaritan, at least in the minds of many people, and even in a few dictionaries. In fact, if you go online and look up the word Samaritan, the first definition is not a person inhabiting Samaria in biblical times, which seems like that should rise right to the top of the definition list, but rather being a good Samaritan is being a charitable or helpful person. Now, most people I know want to be good Samaritans. If you see someone in trouble, you stop and help. This is even a matter of faith. This is about being simply human, a good human. And most of us here are good humans. And so if confronted with a crisis or an emergency, a need, we're more than likely to stop and help. And in that regard, we're a community of good Samaritans. But this is not really what Jesus is trying to teach here, that helping others is good. We know that. I also don't think he's using this parable as a way of dividing people into opposing categories of heroes and villains, which is sometimes how this parable is presented in our day. Even though I agree with the picture behind me, real life is often much more nuanced and complex than a meme. Over the years, I've heard this passage used as a way to just shred the priest and the Levite as being cold-hearted, rule-keeping religionists, devoid of compassion and blind to what it really means to know and follow God. And maybe in this context, maybe that's what Jesus was saying. Maybe it was true in the context of the story, but it doesn't say it, and it's not even necessarily implied. What if we gave both the priest and the Levite the benefit of the doubt? Something that we might wish others would do for us. What if they thought the man really was dead? And by touching him, they would be ceremonially unclean and unable to fulfill their duties, their commitments, their responsibilities to others, people who are depending on them, people who are waiting for them. Or maybe they were afraid that those robbers were still waiting behind the rocks and they were next. Or maybe they had some commitment that seemed so urgent, so important, it was going to cause absolute chaos in the lives of other people if they didn't carry on with what they were doing. Now, please hear me. I'm not making excuses for them. Jesus didn't. And so I'm not making excuses for them. But what I am trying to do is to understand why they may have acted the way they did. To explain it, because I've found myself in those circumstances where I've been confronted by competing duties or responsibilities or choices where it's not absolutely crystal clear what's right or what's best. Maybe there have been times when I've been the priest. And I think it's important to view this parable in this light, because if we don't do it, it's at least easy for me to look at that meme and think, well, that doesn't even apply to me, because of course I would have stopped. But I think at least recognizing those other possibilities helps us see ourselves in this story in ways that are useful. In reality, the parable is not just about being a good neighbor to someone in need, because, again, Luke is pressing into a theme that he's been beating us over the head with now for 10 chapters, that we're also to be a good neighbor to those people that we find hard to love. The scholar understands and at least agrees in his head that mercy to a person in need reflects love for neighbor more than following rituals or being religiously pure, even though both are duties within the law. And by using the Samaritan in the story, Jesus is trying to expand the scholar's concept of neighbor and confronts him with the fact that this isn't heresy at all. This is at the heart of the law, that God's love and grace are universal in scope and not limited to borderlines or bloodlines. He wants us, this is a theme that emerges over and over again in Luke, that God's love is bigger than all that. You see, in the mind of the Jewish person, those Samaritans were not just people inhabiting Samaria. They were inferior in nearly every conceivable way to the Jews. They were half-breeds, mixed blood by marriage, because of those Jews who were left behind when the rest of the clan was exiled to Assyria. And they started marrying pagans and Gentiles. And now they weren't pure-blooded like the good folk back home. Worse yet, they had these heretical beliefs and illegitimate religious practices. Instead of accepting the whole of the Hebrew Bible, they said they only paid attention to the first 5 books of the Hebrew Scriptures. Rather than worshiping in the temple, like every other good Jew, the Samaritans built an altar on Mount Gerizim in about 400 BC, a mountain that they thought Moses had built an altar on. So it was a sacred site where they thought they should worship as well. About 150 years later, when the Jews came and knocked that temple over, it created further hostilities between the two groups. Imagine that. But of course, in the story, it's the Samaritan who puts all that aside. He puts it all aside and does something extraordinarily ordinary. He helps a person in need, who just happens to be one of them. Right? Not us, one of them. And he does more than check on him. He bandages him. He applies that oil and wine that is an antiseptic and brings soothing comfort to his pain. In doing so, he risks danger to himself. Within his own tradition, he's now ceremonially unclean. Man, that's a hard word to say. Ceremonially unclean. And he pays out of his own resources to cover the costs of caring for this person, money that he's probably never going to see again. It's a remarkable story, and it challenges us to ask a crucial question. How am I being neighbor to someone around me that I may struggle to love when they're in need? Now, we could end there, and that would be okay, but if you happen to see the cover of your bulletin, you'll notice that the title of this morning's sermon has nothing to do with the Good Samaritan. Rather, it's about the willing innkeeper, someone we've not even mentioned yet, now 10 or 12 minutes into the sermon. Good golly, what's he doing this morning? Someday we'll consider different ways that one can read and interpret the Bible, but not today. One way that was often used in the Middle Ages was allegorical interpretation, focused primarily on drawing connections between Jesus in the New Testament and making connections to images and stories and things within the Old Testament. Some people say it arose as a way of trying to make sense of the Old Testament, because how do you connect those stories to the preaching of the gospel? So they tried to make these sometimes really obscure connections so that the gospel could be preached. And though I don't usually see it as a helpful way to read or understand the text, there are ways that allegorical interpretation can illuminate the Bible. If, in fact, you allow those connections to emerge out of the text rather than the preacher imposing them on the text, which would be my style of doing it. Well, the theologian and church leader Augustine was famous for allegorical preaching. He loved it. And he came up with countless, and some people would say baseless, connections between New Testament stories and Old Testament images. And I confess, I'm not always a fan of Augustine, but there was one allegorical sermon that he gave where that has just so long intrigued me, and it's based on this story of the Good Samaritan. Whether or not it has any connection or is accurate to the text, let alone in the mind of Jesus as he was telling the story, is not the point. I want to reflect on it this moment, today, because I do believe it has some relevance to what it means to be the church in the world, in our time and place. So in Augustine's sermon, there's a man who happens to be Adam traveling down a road, and he's been stripped of everything, especially his immortality. And he's beaten, and in Augustine's mind, that means he was persuaded by sin, by robbers, who was the devil. He is ignored by the priest, which is the law, and the Levite, which is the prophets, before being attended to by the Samaritan, which is Jesus. And the Samaritan takes him to the inn, which is the church. And he gives 2 months or 2 days' wages, those 2 days being the promises that are found in this life and the promises that are given to us in the next life. And they're paid to the innkeeper to care for this man. Can you see the problem with allegorical interpretation? But setting aside those somewhat obscure connections, I want us to think for just a moment about the often forgotten work of the innkeeper as it relates to being the church. A church that's willing to take risks and commit to the long-term healing of people's lives. Augustine once said, "This is what I and what all of us are doing. We are performing the duties of the innkeeper." He had this sense that the church was both the inn and the innkeeper, the one who receives people after they are beaten and wounded, and it is our job to nurse those folks back to health and healing. We live in a world where there's unending crises and seems like dire emergencies all around us, and our attention is consistently drawn from one place to another. It's like all we are doing is putting out fires. And it seems to me that we are in a culture where we have very short attention spans, and so we are clearly like the person who says squirrel and looks the other way immediately. It's really hard for us to focus on things of substance for a long period of time. And so it begs the question, is where does long-term healing happen? Where do people who are injured, people who are weak, people who are suffering, learn how to stand again? Learn how to walk again? Learn how to put their lives back together again? Where is the community who gathers around people long enough so that they actually not only find healing, but restoration, and maybe even the capacity to then turn and help someone other who's in need? Well, I think that's the church. I think it's always been the intention of the church. I think Augustine is right on this matter. Not that it's the only thing the church does, but it's something that's crucial right at the heart of who we are intended to be. As I said, the innkeeper's often forgotten in this story. Sometimes when I've shared it with other groups, I'll say, tell me all the members, all the characters in this story, and people will go through the whole list. They'll even mention the donkey, but they'll forget the innkeeper. But the innkeeper didn't have to let the person in, right? He saw that wounded, beat-up person. He could have just kept the door closed. He may have recognized that this might be more of a headache than it would be worth. Yet he takes the person in. He risks taking him in with only a promise he would receive payment later to cover the full costs. Now we can assume that he's only in it for the money, but what if we extended the parable? After all, it's a parable, it's a story. What if this is not just the willing innkeeper, but what if it's the good and willing innkeeper? Which is something that we would want to be, I think. Which is something we would hope for if we found ourselves in that situation, that somebody who is good and willing would take us in. And he does, and he nurtures the person back to health. He risks taking them in, not knowing what it would mean for his or more likely her long-term life, but the impact it would have on the person. How much cost there would be, how much expense. Augustine describes the work of the church like that of an innkeeper, that we're called to care for others, to become a haven for travelers, including those who've been so beaten and wounded that they have no strength to carry on. A good innkeeper learns to know their guests well, provides for their needs, and is willing to invest in what they need for their healing and restoration. And in that regard, the inn becomes like a home to them. So much so that maybe even they decide to stay on. Now again, you can see the problems with allegorical preaching. I've already imposed a whole lot of things on the text that are not there. But aren't they there? If you read the whole of the scriptures, aren't they there? And isn't that in fact the work of the church? To walk alongside others, when either by their own hand or the hand of others, they've made such a mess of things that their lives have blown apart. To be a community where someone who is struggling, who needs help learning how to stand and walk, comes alongside them. Where individually and collectively, we are formed into the image of Christ, where we grow out of our own selfishness, our own baggage, our own wounds and hurts, to begin to look more and more like Jesus every day. Not just, again, personally, but communally we do that. To see our lives healed from past hurt, from grief, from trauma, from sin, pain, and our own stupid mistakes. To be a place where we can turn to one another when we have needs. And we all have them. We all will have them. To be a community where we keep hope alive, where we keep loneliness at bay, and we keep love as the first motion of our lives. That's our default. We love rather than give in to fear and hate. Well, in my experience, this doesn't happen by accident. Being this kind of church doesn't happen by accident. It happens as we embrace it. As we, like we did this morning, release people to serve that way. As we share our prayer requests with one another. As we're open and honest with each other about the real needs that we have. But it means that we are willing to put more than band-aids on people. We really do the hard work of walking alongside people who are willing. In my early years in church, I got to know a congregation in Chicago that they were known for trying to help people. And somebody came to them one day and said, "I need a bus ticket. My life's a mess, and I need a bus ticket back home south. I just want to get out of Chicago. I want to go away somewhere else. And the pastor said, we can do that. We can write you a check for, or give you $100 cash for the bus ticket. But we'd also offer to have you come and be a part of our community. Because the person had shared that his life was really in disarray. It was, going home was not necessarily going to solve things. So he said, why don't you come be a part of our community? Let us walk with you. Let us be Christ to you and help you work through those challenges that you have, and you become part of us and you share with us what you have and who you are. And the person was so horrified at that notion. He grabbed the money. He actually didn't take the money. He didn't take the money at all. He just walked out of the office and said, I can't even think about that. I have to get away from here. And he left. But 2 days later, he came back. And he said, I want to talk to you about what that means to be a part of a community like you've just described. And he came and he got involved, and it wasn't easy, right? It wasn't easy. But he came and he got involved. He found his place. It became home. And this person over time began to be a leader and a minister and a help to others within that community and the community that they were serving. I think that's a vision of a church as an inn for people who are struggling and hurt. In the years I worked at Friends United Meeting, I spent a lot of time in East Africa. Every year I would spend about a couple months at our office in Kenya. And in those years I spent a great deal of time in churches and in people's homes. And one of the phrases that they often said to me when I came to a church and was sitting down with church leaders and often around coffee or tea and a meal was, be at home. Be at home. And I thought at first, well, that's a lovely little phrase, be at home. But they really meant be at home here. And they actively looked for ways to love me and support me while I was in their midst. But what I found even more important was, as I got to know the people in those churches, and I went out, not every church, but in lots of them, as I went out and spent time in their homes and in their villages, I heard stories of how families within the church would often take in orphans because there were so many orphans in their village, kids who had nowhere to go. But these families would take those children in and would pay for their schooling. They would raise them as their own children. They would share collectively the costs associated with. They'd send them off to college if the kids wanted to go to college. They would provide them with, over and over again, with opportunities to know what it meant to be loved by God in the context of a community and to learn how to serve, learn how to minister. And it was amazing how many church leaders I knew who had grown up in that life, who had been orphaned but had been loved by their community in such a way that it transformed their life. That's a different context than we have here in Newburgh. I don't know a lot of orphans running around in Newburgh, but I know a lot of people who are looking for a home, who are looking for a community that will come around them in that sort of way. And I'm really glad that we do that in many, many wonderful ways. I think there's probably even more ways that we can lean into that.